Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, June 4th, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, author of the book Spies for Hire, writer for The Nation magazine, Tim Sharrock. On the North Korean summit of next week, hopefully. Meanwhile, SCOTUS sides with a homophobic baker, 7-2, in the most narrowest possible way possible. And Trump's legal team floating self-pardon as we head to the constitutional crisis we all seem to know is coming. Senator Jeff Merkley gets a police exit escort after trying to visit a child immigration detention center. Beautifully housed in a former Walmart in a strip mall. Biggest primaries day of the season. Alabama, Mississippi, New Jersey, California, South Dakota, Iowa, New Mexico. All having primaries tomorrow. Meanwhile, Trump's Germany ambassador launches a broadside on Europe. And, frankly, the State Department. And it seems that Melania is still alive. First Lady scheduled to make a private public appearance in the White House for Gold Star families. And Congress returns today to a trade war, a Democratic immigration battle, and GOP leadership intrigue. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I should just let you know right up front that we are short-staffed today in a big, big way. Matt, super producer Matt, who is never out. He is never out. I don't know if he's ever been out. He is sick. And Jamie had a scheduled bat mitzvah. She's not getting bat mitzvah. Apparently, she's in one of those extended bat mitzvahs that go on in the other parts of the country. Nevertheless, Brendan is now wearing multiple hats, literally one hat, but wearing multiple hats.
What was the game where Kirk Gibson hit the home run on the broken leg? If there's like less than three mistakes, I would say that's akin to that level.
And look at that. He's just hopping on the mic. He's got no problem just hopping on. You forgot to turn on your mic button.
This is not, there's no mic button.
Oh, well, your mic is not up. Wait a second. Oh, yeah, there you go.
I have a stick. You remember?
He's got 20 things to do.
I know.
And
remember when Michael Chang won the French Open and he had to serve underhand?
That's right.
There you go.
I don't remember. But,
did you ever watch tennis, Sam?
Oh, yeah. Back when I used to do other things besides this.
Now you can do other things again, buddy.
Now, well, I'm slowly folding them all in. I'm really getting very close to getting Fortnite on my phone so that I can...
next year we'll watch the playoffs together.
Have my daughter actually acknowledge my presence. We will have Tim Sherrick on in a moment. But let me remind you folks that when I am not prepping or hosting this show, what I'm usually doing is I'm brushing my teeth because I have rediscovered. I went to my 30th college reunion this weekend. And I can't tell you, well, maybe twice. I don't want to exaggerate. But dental hygiene came up in multiple conversations. Because you know, and now people are starting to have to pay for like teeth replacement and stuff like this. Yeah. Yeah, it comes up on you quick. Folks, I'll tell you something. I have a couple years ago, I got convinced I need to have electric toothbrush. I was searching for the perfect one. Well, Quip is an electric toothbrush that costs a fraction of the bulkier brushes, and it packs the right amount of vibrations to clean your teeth. Here's the problem. The electric toothbrush, there's nowhere to put it if you have a sink like I do. There's nowhere to put it. And you keep it in your room, and then you forget to use it, and you never end up using it. If you don't use it, it doesn't work. Quip is basically the size of a regular toothbrush, except for it's an electric. Has a built-in timer, gives you guiding pulses to help you clean for the full dentist-recommended 2 minutes. Here's the key. Its subscription is built for your health. It delivers new brush heads every 3 months for just $5. It's like the cost of a toothbrush, except for you're getting a replenished electric toothbrush. It comes with a suction mount that unsticks. You can use it as a cover for hygienic travel. It's the easiest. It's the only electric toothbrush I've ever been able to travel with. Everybody loves Quip. They were on Oprah's O-List. They were on Time's Best Inventions. They were on Sam's S-List. Just made that, but maybe that could be something I do in the future. If I do, the S-List. It's the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. They're even backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers. It starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip, Q-U-I-P. .com/majority, spelled get, G-E-T-Q-U-I-P, .com/majority, getquip.com/majority. Also, you've heard me in the past talk about texture. Texture is, it is, I would say, well, maybe the airline app that I use, or, you know, if I'm taking the train, the railway app, but it is these, the most used app that I use when I travel. I used it this weekend. Texture. It offers over 200 top magazines all in one place. With Texture, you get complete issues and back issues for titles like Time, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, all in one app. Family Handyman, we've been through this. If you want something lighter, you have People, Cosmo, and Entertainment Weekly. Personally, Family Handyman. Pick up tips. If I get one tip from it's worth it for me. Texture delivers the best of both worlds with newsworthy stories and relaxing entertainment anytime, anywhere. As you know, magazines, if you are the few places you find quality journalism these days, beautiful photos, in-depth interviews, perspectives that show you all sides of a story, deep dive into the issues you care about today with Texture. It's amazing, too, because you can basically create your own magazine. It's sort of like, it sort of like has an Instapaper quality, but it's also, you're pulling from 200 magazines. It's usually $9.99 a month, but they're giving listeners a free trial. First of all, you can end all your magazine subscriptions because you're going to get them all on the Texture. You can start your 7-day free trial. Go to texture.com/majority. That's texture.com/majority. Start reading the latest issues of your favorite magazines today. Texture.com/majority. Check it out. The magazines you're reading now, you'll see them there. All right. This, I don't know how to say this. I mean, I even introduced this. So on Friday, a North Korean delegation visited the White House in anticipation of the summit between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump that's going to happen in about a week or so. And I don't know. We're going to ask Tim Shurik like what this was about. But here is Donald Trump accepting the letter. It's a massive envelope. It's not like a manila envelope. It's like a normal envelope, but just like blown up. And then he starts, he was very cagey about the letter. And I don't understand quite why, but maybe there's a reason. But here is Donald Trump on the letter.
Him a letter from the North Korean leader.
Oh, pause it. I should also say this is a report from friend of show, Mike Hanna on Al Jazeera. And he seems a little bit skeptical about something. Good.
President Trump teased reporters about its content, like the reality show host he once was.
This was a very good meeting. Don't forget, this was a meeting where a letter was given to me by Kim Jong-un, and that letter was a very nice letter. Oh, would you like to see what was in that letter? Would you like? How much? How much? How much?
But subsequently admitted he had not read the letter.
I haven't seen the letter yet. I purposely didn't open the letter. I haven't opened it. I didn't open it in front of the director. I said, would you want me to open it? He said, you can read it later. I may be in for a big surprise, folks.
But he wasn't. After President Trump had departed for Camp David, the White House confirmed he'd read the letter. In a short statement, it says, there were no surprises. Mike Hanna, Al Jazeera, Washington.
President Trump continues to be an effing moron.
He obviously was lying and had not was not surprised by what was in the letter, because at the time he had actually read the letter, making it impossible for its contents to be a surprise to him because he had read it already. As such, there was nothing new in the letter from the time that he had already seen it because he had read it already. Like, but I don't, like, what? I mean, we'll ask Tim Shurik about this, but you get the feeling
baffled.
He's like, oh, they told me not to say I read the letter.
It was so odd because he actually was doing, like, that was decent for a minute. Like, that's, I'm like, oh, wouldn't you like to know what's in it? Like, he was, you know, sort of doing his Trump thing.
Pay me money.
Right. It's like, okay, I guess that's funny enough. I guess our standards have been so degraded that him, like, doing some silly segment on the letter before this major meeting was sort of amusing, and then it was just sort of turned into like a weird, like, I was just lying. I just wanted to lie.
The only thing I can think of is that there was something in the letter that was supposed to trigger something else, and he was trying to say that he didn't need the letter. It's possible there was some promises that North Korea had to make that but that they were going to pretend like the meeting was not contingent upon those promises. So when I saw the letter, I got the promises, then we could go forward. But I forgot I wasn't supposed to say that I saw the letter yet. So we're going forward. I haven't seen the letter, but when I see the letter, there'll be no surprises.
That's probably what it was. Although it would be funny if the letter was really like, they said the Mueller investigation's totally unconstitutional. They said it.
I had North Korean attorneys look at whether or not this was right. They said, wrong, can't do it. All right, look, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to journalist Tim Shurik and author of Spies for Hire on this upcoming North Korean summit. Right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the author of Spies for Hire and foreign correspondent for The Nation magazine, who grew up in Japan and has been writing about North and South Korea for decades. Tim Shurik, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So, Tim, let's start with where are we in terms of the summit? It is going to happen, apparently, right?
That's not apparent anymore. Yes, it's going to happen on June 12th and probably extend into June 13th. But yes, it is happening.
All right. So let's work our way sort of like I want to just, go back a little bit in history to work our way back through this. So what happened? I mean, what has brought this about, this summit? How much of it can we disaggregate is a function of foreign policy by Donald Trump? Or is it more a function of Kim Jong-un and the president of South Korea, Moon Jae-in?
This is much more a function of what's happening between the two Koreas, specifically Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, and the diplomatic offensive he launched when, in January, Kim Jong-un of North Korea said he would be willing to talk and, sent this high-level delegation to South Korea for the Olympics, and that's where it all began. But the impetus came from the Koreas. And, the South and North Korea during the Olympics held some negotiations, and afterwards Moon Jae-in sent his people to Pyongyang to meet directly with Kim Jong-un. And Kim Jong-un at that meeting, this was in March, told the South Koreans that he would welcome a meeting with Donald Trump. The South Koreans came back and went to the White House and told Donald Trump that Kim Jong-un would like to meet with him, and Trump accepted. And so that's how this got going. But on April 27th, the president of South Korea and the leader of North Korea met in Panmunjom, and they made a Panmunjom declaration to move toward a peace process, to sign a peace treaty ending the Korean War that will have to include China and the United States, because both were signatories to the 1953 armistice. And they pledged numerous steps to move forward and to decrease the military tensions, security tensions, and try to increase the engagement between North and South Korea and really move forward on a plan to defuse the crisis and move to a much more of a peace regime in Korea. And so, I would say it's very much in the hands of the Koreas.
Now, so Tim, give us a sense of is the problem between the two Koreas a legacy problem? I mean, are there ongoing things that each side wants? Obviously, they want, I don't want to be threatened. I don't want to feel like we could lose hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of our citizens in some type of war. But when they sit down at the table, what are each side's, demands, requests, aspirations?
Well, are you talking about the two Koreas here?
Yeah.
Koreas.
And then we'll move out to the sort of the third parties.
Well, they've been in a state of war since 1953. The Korean War ended with an armistice.
Right.
There was not a peace treaty. And so, what people on both sides of Korea want is a peace treaty that can, bring a formal end to this war, which, cost the lives of more than 4 million Koreans, 35,000 Americans. But it was a terrible calamity for Korea. And the memories are very deep. And the scars are very deep from that. There's still thousands of divided families. So people want an end to the war and an end to the division and, move more toward reconciliation and eventual unification. They're talking about, systematically how to do that. The way to do that is to, first of all, they both know that the nuclear standoff between North Korea and the United States, must end, and there must be a process to end that, and that's very key to this. But there's a whole plan that they've been talking about, including starting up direct military to military talks, including family visits where families can reunite with their loved ones on both sides of the border. That kind of thing, and then moving towards economic engagement and restarting some of these economic projects that North and South Korea were involved in you know, 10, 15 years ago. So there's this, you know, so you have the Korean objective is to basically, you know, get peace in the Korean Peninsula and, you know, to move to a situation where they can have true reconciliation and some kind of unification.
Now, in terms of this reunification, I mean, if I'm Kim Jong-un, I would imagine I'm nervous about reunification because at one point, if my people start to get a sense of, you know, what the alternatives are in terms of, you know, accountability, in terms of power sharing, I mean, I may be in trouble, like personally, right? Am I mistaken as to what, I mean, that's the fear, isn't it? From a Kim Jong-un, that if we liberalize too much, at one point, the North Korean people are going to say, hey, what's going on with that guy?
Well, North Korea is, you know, fairly isolated, from what's going on in the rest of the world, but, right. You know, people do know a lot about the South and do know a lot about South Korea because, you know, they see TV films and there's all, you know, lots of that kind of information, you know, gets through. So people have been, you know, well aware of the status of South Korea, in terms of its economic development. So, you know, I think that's already, you know, fairly, you know, well known in North Korea. I think that part of what Kim Jong-un is aiming at here is obviously to remain in power and to have the government of North Korea remain stable and in power. But, you know, he's been talking about over the last few years, you know, that there was this emphasis on, you know, building their nuclear capability and their missile capability to build a deterrence against the United States. And they felt, and I think they were correct in this, that they could negotiate from a position of strength once they had that deterrence capability, which right. They have now. And he's been talking about, you know, once you have that and opening negotiations and then trying to rebuild and you know, put more resources into the North Korean economy. And so he's promised his people, you know, sort of, you know, major economic changes as his next step, you know, after already, you know, building this deterrence capability. So, you know, I think that, you know, sure, that's a concern. And I think that in terms of the, you know, knowing how things work in the South, you know, that's a concern. The more North Korean people learn about that, they may want that. But I don't think it threatens the government itself or the, you know, the regime itself.
Okay.
You know, I think that that's a mistaken belief on the part of a lot of Americans and American analysts who think, you know, who thought that we could actually do some kind of regime change in North Korea. It's not going to happen.
Okay. So, what are the interests of China and the United States in the resolution of this conflict or the non-resolution of this conflict?
Well, let's look at the United States first. I mean, look, the United States has, you know, 30,000 troops in South Korea. An American general commands the South Korean army in times of war. The military intelligence services are very integrated. The military, you know, structure is very integrated. Weapon systems, also, to a certain extent, with Japan as well. So the United States has a huge stake here. The United States has major military bases surrounding Korea, in Japan, Okinawa, Guam, has nuclear weapons pointed toward North Korea. You know, U.S. national security interest is to, you know, end this, you know, what they consider nuclear threat to North Korea. And that means there has to be, you know, the North Koreans want an end to what they call the hostile policy, being surrounded by military force, nuclear weapons aimed at them. They want an end to sanctions and an end to the economic embargo. And they would like to be treated as a normal nation and have normalization of economic and political ties, which at one point they did agree with that in the United States under President Clinton. So, you know, in a way, this is, you know, there's a lot of agreements that have been made in the past that can be part of this new agreement with President Trump. So I think, you know, the U.S. has very important, you know, interests and objectives here, but it can only be dealt with, only be realized through negotiations. And that's, you know, thankfully, that's the path that the Trump administration and his national security team, you know, chose to take. And you know, once the door was open earlier in this year, when they had these, you know, with starting with the so-called, you know, Olympic diplomacy. And it began then. And, of course, in the last, you know, few months and weeks, we've seen, you know, the most extensive contacts between, you know, top reaches of the U.S. government and top reaches of the North Korean government, you know, since those Clinton years. I mean, just the other day, you had Kim Jong-un's number two man, Kim Jong-chol, at the White House meeting with President Trump. That's an extremely rare event. So, you know, the two sides have come very far since, you know, a year ago when everyone was fearing a nuclear war breaking out in Korea. You know, and you know, the Chinese are, that China has, you know, interest. They don't have troops there, though. They don't have, you know, any kind of military forces in Korea. It's only the United States that does. China, of course, is allied with North Korea, would like to, does not want to see, you know, a Korea under U.S., under U.S. control and have, you know, American troops on its own border, does not want that. So it wants to support, you know, North Korea, an independent North Korea. And I think there's been some tension between North Korea and China for years. It's somewhat been alleviated over the last few months by these visits by Kim Jong-un with Xi Jinping. He's met with him twice. And they had, since Kim Jong-un came to power, you know, 8 years ago or so, he had never met with the Chinese leadership. So there's a really, you know, major diplomatic shift going on in Korea.
This sounds pretty encouraging. I mean, it's been, talk to us just a little bit. Look, and I think everyone hearing the sound of my voice both knows and probably shares an intense reluctance to give Donald Trump credit for anything. And I don't, I'm not going to credit his, you know, foreign diplomacy skills here necessarily. But this, I mean, there doesn't seem to be really much of a downside for what's going on. I mean, I understand that in terms of negotiating in the past, it has been considered you don't want to give the North Korean leadership the, I guess, I don't know, the symbolic victory of having a unilateral sit down with the president of the United States, because that gives them more legitimacy. But I mean, at this point, like, where are they getting, how would they expend this legitimacy anyways? Right? Like, I mean, what is there a danger here, I guess? Let me put it that way. Aside from Donald Trump going in there and, I don't know, blowing the whole thing up.
Well, you know, the danger is that the negotiations, you know, don't work out and we go back to a war situation or, you know, or confrontation. And that's no good for anybody. I mean, you know, it's I'm really kind of amazed, really, by the U.S. liberal media and the liberal intelligentsia here, which, because they hate Trump so much. And of course, I have no love for Trump, but, you know, he made the right decision in agreeing to meet with Kim Jong-un. And I, you know, I applaud that. And I think that his people, and, you know, Pompeo, Mike Pompeo used to be the CIA director, now Secretary of State, they've done the right thing in reaching out and agreeing to these negotiations. Now, there's a lot of talk, there's been a kind of liberal freak out here in the United States about this. I mean, it began in the instant Trump said he was going to meet with Kim, and people saying exactly that, you know, you're giving North Korea this huge concession and why are you giving them equality with the United States and so on? You know, well, you know, look, we've been at war with them for you know, a generation. And the United States did a lot of harm to Korea. They bombed, completely destroyed North Korea during the Korean War. I mean, we were responsible for millions of deaths by firebombing in North Korea. They remember this. You know, there's no reason not to, you know, of course we should sit down and talk and work out an agreement and work out a peace agreement. You know, that benefits everybody, but mostly it benefits the Korean people. And, you know, over the last few days, you know, the big hue and cry from the media here and lots of critics of Trump is that, oh, he's going to sign a peace agreement. You can't have a peace agreement without first having denuclearization. Well, why can't you have a peace agreement if the two sides want to have peace? And they still have nuclear weapons. Well, we still have nuclear weapons. Right. I mean, you can have peace. You can reach an agreement and have a move forward from there on step by step what to do after that in terms of denuclearization and removing North Korea can shut down its nuclear program. I mean, it's already stopped all testing. So I think, you know, this is the beginning of a negotiated peace, really. And so, you know, I give credit to Donald Trump for that. And I think it's been a lot of questions with John Bolton being his national security advisor. And I think Bolton almost single-handedly, you know, blew things up by pushing what they call this Libya option on North Korea, which North Korea sees as regime change on steroids, basically. And so, you know, when Trump and Pompeo met the other day with Kim Jong-chol, the senior North Korean official, John Bolton was not in the room. So, you know, I think his influence has been somewhat diminished because of his statements and the very, very hard line. But, you know, I think we should applaud this move toward peace. I mean, this is a huge thing. You know, there's 50 million people in South Korea, 25 million in North Korea, approximately. And, you know, they've been facing war and division for years, decades. And it's, you know, it's time to bring that to an end. And if there's a chance here to do it, we should want it as Americans. I just don't understand the antipathy towards Trump on this issue.
Yeah, I wanted to. I mean, that's, I guess, what I'm getting at. And I want to just hit this one point again, that this is the only risk here, it seems to me, is that we get back to where we were, I don't know, 2 weeks ago, right? I mean, is there a possible scenario where Trump goes in there and, I suppose anything is possible, but within the realm of, like, you know, of reason, is there a scenario where something comes out of this meeting that's worse than the situation is now?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, to some people, yes. I mean, to some people, any move toward a peace agreement is worse. You know, I mean, the opposition to a peace treaty here in the United States and Korea is just incredible to me. I mean, I just don't understand where these people are coming from. They obviously don't look at it from the point of view of Korea. It's just always, you know, U.S. national security interests. I think U.S. national security interests would be served by peace in Korea. The fear is to go back not to 2 weeks ago, but to a year ago when, you know, they were North Korea was, you know, testing
right,
hydrogen bomb, testing missiles one after the other. And Donald Trump was threatening them with fire and fury and, you know, total destruction if they didn't back down. So we don't want to go back to that kind of situation. And, you know, I think if the Koreas, as they have said, want to have a peace treaty and end the war between them, which in many ways, you know, was a civil war, then it's their right as a sovereign nation to do that. And I think the United States should do everything it can to support that process.
How much of the, I mean, I understand, I guess, you know, what we're hearing a little bit from, you know, the liberals or the left on some level, because I think it's just an intense desire not to give credit to Donald Trump. I can understand that. I think that's wrongheaded in this context because there's much bigger issues at play. But when you look at someone like Bolton, and I wonder if there isn't another part of the U.S. national security apparatus that isn't reluctant, because I'm not quite sure why Bolton would be, per se. I mean, I just know that he would be. I mean, he clearly was trying to blow this thing up by comparing them to Libya. That is not a buy this product, and you'll end up just like the guy who whose house burned down because they used it, essentially, is what he was pitching. Right. But is there, I mean, with 30,000 some odd troops, U.S. troops there, are there elements of the U.S. national security apparatus that are like, hey, this is bad for business on some level?
Well, yes, there's a lot of, you know, so-called North Korea experts here and the think tanks that don't want to diminish the U.S. strategic role in South Korea at all. I mean, they want to maintain these bases forever. And, you know, I think that should be a decision that's up to the South Korean people. There's a lot of mixed feelings here about you know, the U.S. role. But I think that what a lot of people don't understand is that even North Korea, you know, Kim Jong-un and his, you know, previous governments in North Korea, when they've entered into negotiations, the North Koreans have said, once a peace treaty is signed and a peace regime is set up, they might be willing to accept the presence of U.S. military forces in South Korea for a certain amount of time, even after an agreement. And in some ways, in recent weeks, we've seen, you know, China has taken a harder line than North Korea on the U.S. forces in South Korea. So I think, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding of what, you know, North Korea, you know, wants out of this. But I think, you know, mostly, you know, it wants to be viewed as a normal nation and proceed that way. I mean, it's to me, it's conceivable that they will eventually give up their nuclear weapons and perhaps, you know, send their warheads to some other country and, you know, get rid of their plutonium program and uranium enrichment program under international supervision. But they have to be convinced, and there's got to be very strong U.S. security guarantees, that it's not going to try to attack them again. It's not going to try to attempt regime change in what, you know, whatever form. I mean, they've got to be convinced of that. There's got to be those very strong guarantees. And I think that's part of what is being discussed. I mean, look, Pompeo went to North Korea twice, met twice with Kim Jong-un. And, of course, you know, this gentleman who was here the other day, Kim Jong-chol, his number two guy, who used to be the head of North Korean intelligence, was at those meetings, too. So they have hashed out a lot of this already. And, you know, Pompeo made it very clear that all these issues were on the table. So, you know, I think that what we're going to see in Singapore is you know, I'm hearing that one of the centerpieces is going to be, you know, support for a peace treaty. And it's possible that South Korean President Moon Jae-in may fly in for the second day when they will kind of celebrate this, you know, end of the Korean War. And Trump has been kind of hinting at this and talking about it himself. And that is a huge, huge thing. That is just that would be an enormous event in our history to end that war.
How are other players in the region, Japan? I mean, where are their concerns? What are their aspirations?
Well, look, Japan is ruled by this, you know, cranky right-wing liberal democratic party, Abe Shinzo, you know, whose grandfather was a colonial official in Manchuria and actually chased when Kim Jong-un's grandfather, Kim Il-sung, was a guerrilla fighting Japanese. You know, Abe's grandfather was chasing Kim Il-sung around North Korea and Manchuria. I mean, there's this long history between Japan and Korea. You know, there was a colonial power there for, you know, 1910 to 1945. It was a very cruel colonization. So, you know, yeah, they've been mounting concerns about the missiles as well as these Japanese who were kidnapped by North Korea years ago. But they've been pushing a very hard line, and every time Abe meets with Trump, the line gets harder. And Abe's going to be here this week to meet with Trump before he goes to Singapore. So, you know, I think, you know, their interests, I think, are not really that important in this situation, because they don't have a role to play in the discussions between North and South Korea. And the North Korea nuclear weapons are aimed primarily at the United States. they see the deterrence against the United States. They just see Japan as a kind of junior partner with the U.S. and its military, and you know, the military structure that's been set up in East Asia over the last, you know, 50, 60 years. So, you know, other players, you know, Russia, of course, you know, shares a small border with North Korea, land border. It's the only land border North Korea has. And they've had relationships with, you know, North Korea for, you know, since the end of the Korean, end of the World War II. The Soviet Union, you know, occupied the northern part of Korea after Japan surrendered. And, you know, of course, you know, the Russian foreign minister was there meeting with Kim Jong-un the other day. I mean, the Russians have been talking about economic projects with North and South Korea for many, many years, including, you know, pipeline projects, energy projects. So I think there's a lot of interest in the region. If there can be peace between the Koreas, there's a lot of economic growth and shifts that can come, a lot of projects that people are, you know, really interested in pursuing if you have peace. So I think, you know, overall, there's a very positive interest in this in the surrounding countries.
And lastly, I guess, if in terms of signing on, I mean, the United States as a member, or I should say as a co-signer on the armistice agreement, within domestically in terms of the United States, does the president have unilateral ability to basically sign off on, a peace accord in this instance? There doesn't need to be any type of Senate approval or anything like that, does there, to essentially end the war?
You know, technically, I don't know the answer to that, but I think any kind of peace treaty that the United States would sign would need to be, you know, should be approved by, should go before the Senate, because it would, you know, it would close this war out and it'd be an international treaty, and China would have to sign it too. But I think, you know, the president has a fair amount of unilateral power, you know, to do such a thing. But I think in the interest of you know, full debate and, you know, transparency, that it should be looked at by the Congress and approved by the Congress, because it's a good idea. The time has come for that kind of peace treaty.
Is there any, can you imagine a scenario where, the Senate would not sign on to something like that? I mean, I don't really have a sense of.
It's possible. I kind of don't see it under Trump with, you know, Republican control.
Right.
I think it would pass. I mean, you know, in past agreements, like, for example, the famous agreed framework that Clinton and the leader at the time, you know, Kim Il-sung, and then his son agreed to, where the North Koreans, by the way, froze their, you know, nuclear program for almost 12 years. This was time before they had built the nuclear weapon. You know, so they at that time, you know, as soon as that agreement was in place, actually a month after it was signed in November 94, the Republicans took control of the House. And led by Newt Gingrich, they began to attack the Clinton agreement as appeasement. And so actually, you know, there was a lot of problems were caused by congressional meddling with this agreement, which did not come before the Senate as a treaty. It was a three or four page agreement that where the United States, you know, agreed to certain things, including providing fuel oil to while they shut down their nuclear reactors. But, you know, Congress actually delayed paying for that oil, and it caused a lot of friction between the North Koreans. The North Koreans began to think that the U.S. was reneging on the agreement, and that led to North Korea doing some things where it was kind of going around the agreement. For example, when it was, you know, the Bush administration accused it of starting a uranium program in 2002.
Right.
And the Bush administration used that as an excuse to rip up the whole agreed framework, which was really stupid because at the time, North Korea was, in fact, importing technology for uranium enrichment, but it did not have a uranium enrichment program. And they were also willing to talk about it at the time. And then Bush just made this unilateral decision, which was backed, of course, by John Bolton at the time, who was the UN ambassador. and by Dick Cheney. They had come to power thinking that they wanted to do away with this agreement anyway. So, you know, there's a long history of, sort of problems after agreements have been signed. It's not all North Korea, violating the agreement,
right,
like the U.S. media would like you to think. It's not that at all.
I mean, I think back during the Bush years, there was at least an understanding that the Bush administration had basically, it wasn't, like you say, North Korea wasn't perfectly aligned with the agreement, but essentially was. And all right, so let me just, I guess, lastly, is what about the United Nations? I mean, do they have any role in the resolution of this conflict? Are they simply out of it now?
The UN, of course, UN Security Council has passed, over the last year, passed some very tough sanctions against North Korea. So any kind of sanctions that are lifted, that are UN sanctions out of any kind of agreement would have to, of course, go before the UN Security Council and go back to the UN. So that's one role they have to play. If you recall, during the Korean War, the U.S. was in command of what was called the UN,
right?
The UN forces, right? So, I mean, ostensibly, the U.S. commander in Korea is in charge of the U.N., but it's really kind of a fig leaf. It's really the United States. But the U.N. command is in charge of the area around the demilitarized zone, Panmunjom, if you want to cross the border from north to south or south to north, on foot or by bus, you have to get permission from the UN commander, who is the top U.S. general. So, they have a role to play, but particularly in the role of lifting and, changing the sanctions.
Interesting. Well, Tim Sherrick, is there anything else that you think we should know as we start to gear up for this summit? I mean, it sounds like it's conceivable that they're going to walk away from this summit with, if not explicit, sort of imminent end to the Korean Civil War, I guess.
Well, that's what I'm looking for, and I think we should look for what happens if Moon Jae-in does actually show up for the second day and they actually do make the sort of formal announcement ending the war. That would be a huge thing. I, by the way, have raised enough money through crowdfunding and through the nation to go there and cover it for the nation. And also covering for the, Korea Center for Investigative Journalism. And, I've done this on my own. I crowdsourced. A lot of people support my independent reporting. And I raised a fair amount of money, to get there and back and to write about this. So, I have, watched my reporting, and, I'll be posting stuff on, at the nation. And also I have a website now called Dispatch Korea. And also I have a Twitter feed at Timothy S, where I post a lot of stuff about what's going on, but I'll be doing that. I'm leaving on Saturday. And so I'll be there, for the full summit on the 12th and the 13th.
All right. Well,
I'm very optimistic about what may happen.
We will put all those links in today's show notes and also at majority.fm. Tim Sherrick, have a great trip, and hopefully you will be reporting on the end of the Korean Civil War, which would be an amazing, amazing for a myriad of reasons. Obviously, most amazing for the Korean people. But Tim, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. I really appreciate being on your show.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. There you have it. it's, I don't know what to say. The idea that, we would end the Korean conflict and denuclearize, ultimately, the Korean Peninsula. It's also very possible that things are going to go sideways, not the least of which I imagine the idea has got to be, we're going to put the old man on a plane and give him something to sort of sedate him, and maybe he'll be half asleep during the whole thing, and we can just move forward. But there's going to be a significant contingency within the U.S. government that I think would not want this to happen. And so it'll be interesting to see what they do in that instance. I imagine guys like John Bolton are having mixed feelings. One hand, they want this opportunity to bomb North Korea. On the other hand, they're probably saying, this is going to give us 100% focus on getting into a war with Iran. And, you know, peace over here, war with Iran, you get away with it, right? Because you've got you got one chit in your pocket, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, oh, we're not warmongers. We started peace here. And the reason why we're not doing it with Iran is because they're bad. I mean, I wonder, it's interesting. You see Bolton, right, pushed aside for North Korea. And what did he do this past week? He hires Frank Gaffney's, you know, he staffs up with a bunch of Frank Gaffney folks who are virulently anti-Islam and anti-Muslim. And so it'll be interesting to see. But, as difficult I think it is for people who perceive Donald Trump with some type of clear-eyed vision, that he would be overseeing the U.S. government as we, you know, do not stand in the way of, at least, peace between the North and South Korea. You know, you gotta think of the Korean people, and they don't care. They don't care. But boy, oh boy, that makes for the good fictionalized version of all of this is going to be that much better, right? When they have Trump Square in both North and South Korea. Jesus.
Spend all of his post-presidential years just touring Korea again and again and again, right, and again.
We're number Hana. I know how to count in Korean because I used to take Taekwondo.
So. Nice.
Folks, just a reminder, this program relies on you, on listeners not like you, on you. And you, actually not you, move over there, you, we need your support to keep this show going. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. It is a couple of bucks a week. What's that break down to? 15 cents a day? Every day we strive, even if like half the team is out, to provide for you an in-depth interview, maybe an update on some of the important stories that you don't necessarily get on television or, frankly, other podcasts. I don't know. I'm sure someone else has interviewed Tim Shurik and Gerald Horn in the course of 5 days, but I don't know who it would be.
Anthony Cumia.
Anthony Opie?
Yeah, Anthony Opie.
Yeah, that's true. Opie and Anthony. Those
I
guys.
Like that, Anthony Opie.
Whatever.
That's good.
Anyways, folks, join themajorityreport.com. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you the fun half. If you don't want to listen to it, you don't have to. You can just support the show and feel good about supporting something that you listen to on a regular basis. Join themajorityreport.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Tomorrow is Tuesday, the Michael Brooks Show. Check it out. You can subscribe on iTunes or head over to his Patreon page. And the Antifada is also with the Patreon page, patreon.com. That's Jamie's show. And Matt has a new show that is not about politics, but it's really only if you're smart. So look yourself in the mirror and say, am I smart? And if you are, then you're going to want to head over to Literary Hangover. It's you can subscribe on iTunes, and it's also got a Patreon page. What is it, patreon.com? Does anybody know? Patreon.com/literary hangover would be my guess. That would be the smart one to do. But Google Literary Hangover. I can't imagine there's too many people. He named his podcast like he would name a band, in a way, didn't he?
Yeah.
It's like a band name.
But it is patreon.com/literary hangover.
My understanding is, and I haven't had a chance to listen to the first one yet, but I did subscribe. I'm ready to listen to it. It's basically like you want to read cliff notes of, you know, some great literary works, but then you want to take it a step further and hear what it's like the themes applied to the historical context in which these books are written.
It's like the context of great literature.
You're going to get hit. Oh, my God. Forget it. I mean,
very cerebral.
Very cerebral. But, I mean, if you're not smart, don't listen to it.
No. Don't even try.
Right. Wait, I already tried. Waste of my time.
Yeah. Brendan got really confused. He got disoriented. In fact, they had to put out one of those Amber Alerts
for him. It gave me a hangover, folks.
There you go.
Ooh.
Boom. All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half.